Good morning. May it please the court, Douglas Hirsch for the petitioner, Full Value Advisors. The SEC stated in the full value orders denying its request for a 13F2 exemption that 13F1 serves, the disclosures made under 13F1 serves a variety of research and enforcement purposes. That was the statement made by them in the order. However, we now know, pursuant to the 28J letters the court received, that the SEC's Inspector General found that, quote, despite those statements in its order concerning the use of Form 13F information for a variety of oversight and other purposes, the SEC does not, in fact, conduct any continuous or systematic review or analysis of that information. And, Your Honors, this is what we've contended all along, that 13F1 disclosures are not used for any regulatory purpose by the SEC. In fact, the Inspector General said there is no systematic review. There's no one assigned at the SEC to look at this information. The Inspector General found that the information goes out to the public without being reviewed, contains errors. This may be a
errors that are submitted.
Yes, errors that are submitted, exactly. That the information
submitted by the regulated firm.
That's correct. If the regulated
the SEC doesn't add errors, they just pass them along.
That's my understanding of the report, yes, Your Honor. So that the information isn't necessarily even accurate.
I'm not sure why you're making this point.
Yeah, I'm not sure either.
The reason I'm making this point is because it goes to our argument that there is no compelling governmental interest, that strict scrutiny applies, and that the Commission has failed to make any argument that there's a compelling governmental interest as to why this court should ignore my client's First Amendment rights, and that even if this court applied a commercial speech standard, which there's no basis to do, there's no substantial interest. It is beyond dispute in this case that there is no compelling interest under the First Amendment. Even under a commercial speech standard, there's no substantial interest. And with regard to a takings clause analysis under Penn Central, there's not even a legitimate interest. There is no purpose to this statute except that it's nice for the public to have this information. And while it would be nice for the public to have lots of things, that does not serve as a justification to violate my client's constitutional rights. The Supreme Court.
I take it there's no meaningful distinction between the provision to which you're objecting and the 5% threshold in the other section.
Under 13D, is that what Your Honor is asking?
Yeah. The Williams Act, 13D. You're in 13F.
We haven't performed a constitutional analysis of 13D because that's not before this court. But, you know, it strikes me that 13D is much more akin to proposing a commercial transaction because it's involved, it's triggered when it's focused on determining whether someone is trying to take over a company. And so it's a tender offer is more of a proposed commercial transaction.
Congress made a decision that the 5% threshold should be a warning to management, right, that they may be subject to further acquisitions. It's a way of frustrating the market for corporate control, basically, and favoring incumbent management.
I mean, that's one view, yes. It certainly could be viewed that way.
Why isn't that equally true for pools of capital in excess of $100 million with a lower threshold? The Congress is interested in frustrating the market for corporate control because managements have petitioned the Congress for protection from hostile takeovers.
No, I don't agree. I think Congress said there is no danger of that when you're below 5%. And, in fact, that's not found anywhere in the legislative history of 13F.
Where'd they say you're in no danger if it's below 5%?
They don't talk about it at all.
No, as I read it, they're also saying, but unless the acquirer has a pool of capital in excess of $100 million, In which case, you may well be.
No, my recollection is Congress set the 100 million.
Remember, all we have to do is, go ahead.
I'm sorry. My recollection is Congress set the $100 million mark because they didn't want to burden smaller managers with having to file 13F1 disclosures. That there was no, I'm not aware of any discussion that the idea was that, oh, if you manage 100 million or more, you have the capability of frustrating corporate control of certain companies. I mean, that just simply wasn't discussed anywhere in the legislative history.
Of acquiring it.
Of acquiring a company. It wasn't discussed anywhere in the legislative history of 13F. 13F, Congress specifically said, we want this disclosed because we think it would be really helpful to the public to have this information. It would help them make investment
decisions.
That's
not in the statute. You're talking about legislative history.
Yeah, that's the legislative history.
That's not
why
what
Congress
they enacted.
Said it enacted the statute. That's what Congress said was the purpose of
it. Well, some committee said it, some members said it, some may have even believed it, but that's not the statute.
That's correct. It's not in the statute, Your Honor. And so Lowe and CTS and Toucher all say that impersonal investment advice is fully protected constitutional speech, that in those cases, people were publishing newsletters. They were stating their opinion about a specific security, whether to buy, hold, or sell it. And in all of those cases, the courts had no problem determining that that
was
fully protected speech.
That's not the kind of information that's at stake here.
It is, Your Honor. There is, what I contend is, if my client took his 13F1 disclosure and called it the full value newsletter, and said, I'm going to go publish the full value newsletter. The full value newsletter would say, I, full value, purchased so-and-so stock on so-and-so date. Here's the number of shares I bought, which is exactly what was published in Lowe, which was exactly what was published in CTS and Toucher. Okay?
You didn't do that.
Riley instructs that there is no difference between a prior restraint, restraining someone from publishing a newsletter, and compelling speech, compelling someone to publish a newsletter. Okay? There's simply no difference between those two scenarios.
Zouder says that, Zouder, however you pronounce it, it's rational basis review for the disclosure of economic information.
I'm sorry?
It's rational basis under Zouder for disclosure of economic information. Zouder is still good law, and we've endorsed it.
But Lowe is much more on point.
Well,
Lowe is the case.
I can understand why you would argue that, and I'm suggesting to you, as one judge in the panel, my initial read of the cases is I don't agree with you.
I would.
And I don't understand how you get there. It seems to me that Zouder is the correct law, and it's still good law. It's been applied by this court.
Of course,
you're going to characterize whether it's favorable. I'm suggesting to you I have a problem with the characterization.
Zatterer was a commercial speech case, okay? It wasn't fully protected speech. And in Zatterer, because it was a commercial transaction, the court applied a completely different standard.
I know it's different.
They were trying to protect
what I'm saying to you. I think that's the applicable standard. It's the reporting of economic information. I think there's a legitimate legislative basis, and the agency is simply applying what Congress told it to do.
Your Honor, I strongly disagree.
Doesn't mean anything to
me. I understand. I'll tell you why.
I know you strongly disagree. That's why I'm raising the question.
Let me tell you why I strongly disagree. The reason I strongly disagree is because in order for there to be commercial speech, to lower from the strict scrutiny to commercial speech standard, my client has to be proposing a commercial transaction, okay? In Zatterer, there was a proposed commercial transaction. I think there was some solicitation of advertising, and the court was, the statute was concerned with deceptive practices in making a solicitation. My client isn't proposing any commercial transaction. My client doesn't even want to speak. My client doesn't want to sell any advice to the public.
You think Zouder and the cases that follow it say that as a condition of the principles stated there, you have to have someone who is proposing a transaction?
Absolutely.
I don't read the cases that way.
Absolutely.
The fact that may have happened in some of the cases, I don't think is a conditioned precedent to the application of rational basis review.
In fact, I am saying that it's a sine qua non of commercial speech standard that there must be a proposed commercial transaction. That is what distinguishes the commercial speech standard from the strict scrutiny standard, which applies here. And in fact, the SEC in its brief doesn't even argue that the commercial speech standard applies. In fact, they go straight to a 1988 decision from this court, Wall Street Publishing, which hasn't been followed by any court, in which this court created... I'm sorry?
Been followed by our court.
No, I'm not aware of a decision that's from this court that follows that, that applies the exception.
Have we abandoned it?
I would say yes.
What decision in our circuit, what three-judge panel has abandoned another three-judge panel and said it's no longer the law?
When you use the term abandoned, I'm interpreting that to mean that it hasn't been followed.
It's the law of the circuit. It just is the law of the circuit. I'm not even understanding your argument.
Okay,
the law of the circuit is the law of the circuit. And we don't care whether 12 other circuits agree or disagree. It's the law of this circuit. So that argument's a non-starter.
To the extent that's the law of this circuit, it's incorrect. It carved out a fourth exception.
So if we have to rely on that and you want to seek en banc review, help yourself. It's the law of the circuit.
I understand. So,
and I don't know how you get around it.
Well, I'll tell you, it's since been overruled by a case from the Supreme Court called Liquor Mart, which states that essentially you cannot, just because an area is, Liquor Mart says.
I tried to follow that argument, and I don't see the overruling, but go ahead.
Liquor Mart says just because you heavily regulate an area of law, that doesn't give the government the right to suppress speech. And this court's decision in Wall Street Publishing said exactly that. It said because securities are a heavily regulated area, we're going to create a fourth new exception to your First Amendment rights, and we're allowed to suppress speech because it involves securities. And there was no authority to do that. There was no precedent for that. And that's clearly inconsistent with the Supreme Court's ruling in Liquor Mart. So I would suggest to this court that the Wall Street Publishing case has since been overruled.
Your argument this far has been the disclosure requirement compels speech, but you also say in your brief, or at least you seem to say, that what's being compelled, what you're being compelled to disclose is a trade secret, essentially. Or is that your argument? I guess I should start there.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, so you're making both of those arguments.
That's right.
It's compelled speech and that it's disclosure of a trade secret.
It's a compelled speech in violation of our First Amendment rights, and it also is a taking of a trade secret in violation of our Fifth Amendment rights.
So can you tell me what exactly is the trade secret that you're being compelled to disclose?
The trade secret is our investment opinion, the conclusion of our investment research, our investment analysis, and our investment opinion. My client spends a significant amount of money and time in researching and investigating good investments. And at the end of that process makes a conclusion that something is or is not a good investment. And people pay my client significant fees for that opinion. The investors in the hedge fund, the limited partners, pay fees to the general partner for that advice. And in fact, as we set forth in the record and our papers, a whole industry has arisen where they copy that investment advice. There's, for example, one example is someone that started the Alpha Clone Fund, who the entire business, the entire strategy of that hedge fund is to review 13F1 reports and see who are the successful money managers, the Warren Buffetts of the world, the David Einhorns, the full value Phil Goldsteins of the world, and then copy their investments. Say they bought so-and-so security on so-and-so date, now we'll buy it. And they mimic the entire portfolio. And that's our product. That's what we sell. That's our trade secret that we don't even disclose to our limited partners unless some limited partner negotiates for that disclosure, and in that case, we make them sign a confidentiality agreement because that is our trade secret.
So it's just the composition of the funds. It's not some, you're not saying it's because they can derive some formula by working backwards from.
It's the result of our research. It's the fact that we're buying this security because the strategy that we pursue is an activist strategy. And an activist strategy is one where you are saying essentially that a company is undervalued for some reason. So the mere fact that we own that security signals to the entire world that we think that security is undervalued, that the product of our research has resulted in a conclusion that the security is undervalued. And once that is disclosed to the public, they have now received the benefit of all of our research, all of the time and money we spent, and it harms our investors because and our business because our investors are saying, well, why am I paying fees for this information if, in fact, you can get that information for free by waiting 90 days, by waiting a quarter, at the end of the quarter and disclosing it?
You didn't seek confidentiality exception.
We did not, because we believe that the act of turning over the information, once my client has to turn over the information to the commission and seek confidentiality, his First Amendment rights have been violated right there. That is the compelled speech. The fact that the commission is forcing us to turn over our investment ideas to them, that's right there. That violates our First Amendment rights, and it also violates our Fifth Amendment rights.
You're saying disclosure to the SEC for the purpose of getting protection, not for the purpose of the quarterly reports to the public, is the appropriation of your trade secret?
Yes, it's compelled.
Why the SEC? Because the SEC people are going to engage in insider trading?
No.
Then why?
For two reasons. One, I just want to make clear, it's compelled speech, okay? And I think you're asking solely about the takings argument. Is that correct?
Well, let's focus on the it could be that. Yeah, let's take the takings argument.
Okay. It's...
But it's also a question of ripeness and so on. Go ahead.
Because it's a constitutional challenge, it's ripe. The ripeness arguments that the commission makes have to do with reviewing administrative rulings, and the policy behind the cases they cite regarding finality is they don't want the court to waste judicial resources, and they do not want the court to entangle itself in something that is an administrative matter until there's been a final decision. But because there's a constitutional challenge here, and because the commission says that they presume that all of the laws they regulate are presumptively constitutionally valid, this case is absolutely right, ripe for a constitutional determination.
Ripeness also reflects the rule of avoidance, that we don't get into constitutional issues unnecessarily. So here you're saying there's a taking, but we don't even have an instance in which there's a particular stock. The value of the stock may have gone down. Your advice might not have been good. We don't know that there's anything at stake here.
Oh, I disagree, Your Honor. Once the information is given to the SEC, even for a confidentiality application, there's been a taking of my client's trade secret. It's no longer a trade secret. It's been given to a third party, okay, without any promise of confidentiality.
So
they may make it confidential.
Suppose we had a litigation in the district court, and you want to proffer a trade secret to the court to seek protection and exclude it from evidence. Proffering it to the court is a disclosure?
I think it could be, unless you take certain confidentiality, make certain provisions for confidentiality. I mean, I think that's what's normally done.
Well, when
in
you
a
give
trade
something
secret
to the
case.
Court and not to your opposing party, it is confidential, is it not?
Yeah, but when you give it to the court in the scenario that you're talking about,
yeah,
you know in advance that the court has agreed to treat it as confidential.
So you're worried the SEC will treat your request for protection as an occasion for disclosure?
Absolutely. They don't have to treat it as confidential. It's completely within their discretion whether they deem it confidential or not.
Now, we're not talking about your quarterly disclosures.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about an interim request saying we don't want our disclosures to be revealed.
The interim request?
Yeah.
No, there's no trade secret involved in that request.
Okay. So is the only way you can make this request to staple it to your quarterly disclosure?
Yes, the SEC requires you to disclose all your holdings, your trade secrets, to them when you make that request. I mean, that's the information they require.
Right. And right now, you're making those disclosures to them and they're releasing them.
No, we didn't make those disclosures to them. That's one of their gripes, frankly, is that we didn't, apply for confidential treatment.
You never complied by 13F? I didn't realize that.
No, we didn't. We didn't give them that information. So if your honors don't have any further questions, I'll save whatever time you'll give me for rebuttal.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Tracy Harden for the Securities and Exchange Commission. And I want to speak first to the topic you were just discussing with Full Values Counsel, and that's the relevance of the confidential treatment process. It's the Commission's position that that process does have the potential to eliminate, if not, or at least mitigate, both of the constitutional concerns here. As your honors have touched on, the confidential treatment process is designed to protect potential trade secrets, or at least holdings which implicate trade secrets, from dissemination to the public. And it therefore has the basis to eliminate any Fifth Amendment takings issue. Now, Full Value has contended that the required disclosure, confidential disclosure to the Commission of its holdings for purpose of a confidential treatment determination itself constitutes a taking, but that's simply not the case. The way the process works, any holdings for which confidential treatment is requested stay confidential pending that determination. And while the Commission does have some discretion in granting a request for confidential treatment, that discretion is bounded by the terms of the statute, the legislative history, and the Commission's own rules, and certainly any final determination would be subject to judicial review. So we simply do not think that there's a takings issue with submitting a confidential treatment request in the first instance.
So let me make sure I understand. So the request is submitted to you, or would be. Has this happened? Not with there, but I mean other instances.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
All right. So someone submits a request to you. So here's our quarterly disclosure. And stapled to it is our request that you hold this confidential in perpetuity, and you deny that request.
Well, the way
you don't just then publish, you don't disclose the information.
No, the way it works, typically, you know, it is not always the case that investment managers are seeking confidential treatment for every holding for all time. It's actually, you know, as it's designed, sometimes it's just for certain holdings for a certain period of time, and that's usually the case.
Are those ever granted?
Yes. Yes.
What's one of the reasons for granting such a...
The very reason actually put forward by Full Value here, which is why we think that this really is a solution or a potential solution in this case. Securities which are the subject of an ongoing program of acquisition or disposition, and if the filer can show that revelation of those holdings would reveal an investment strategy prematurely, that is a basis for confidential treatment. So to return to sort of the mechanics of the process, what happens is an institutional investment manager submits the non-confidential portion of their 13F filing electronically, and it goes up on the Commission's website with a legend saying, some holdings are omitted because confidential treatment has been requested. And there's no designation of how many or which holdings are subject to a request. The confidential treatment request is then submitted in paper form to the Commission. And it does, the process does require that they disclose what those holdings are and what the investment strategy is, simply because the Commission has to make a determination as to whether it's appropriate for confidential treatment. So we need that information. And then if a request is denied, then the filer has 6 days, essentially, from the denial to submit an amended electronic version of the filing with the information. And certainly, that's usually done by staff delegated authority. There's a process by which they can seek review by the Commission, and if they do so, it remains confidential. And then, of course, there's a possibility of judicial review after.
And again, it remains confidential.
Right. That's correct.
And has that ever happened?
Judicial review? This case.
There was no submission in this case.
There was a confidential treatment request in name only, essentially. What they did was make the very same argument they've made here.
A generic assertion
without any disclosure of securities information, which is why those confidential treatment requests were denied here. There was no way to make a determination.
What is your response to, the Wall Street case is a thorn in their side, and their answer to that thorn is that it's been effectively overruled by the plurality opinion in Liquormart. What is your response to that? I mean, I hear them essentially conceding, and a rebuttal they can say otherwise, that if Wall Street is it, they're in trouble. Their response to that, as I understand, because it's the law of the circuit, unless it's been effectively overruled. And they say Liquormart effectively overrules it. Go ahead.
We simply disagree for several reasons. First, as Your Honor pointed out, that was a plurality opinion, and this court has never backed away from its holding in Wall Street Publishing. But also, I think that this court in Wall Street Publishing and the court in the Supreme Court in 44 Liquormart were making really different points. What this court said in Wall Street Publishing was that in areas of comprehensive economic regulation, like the securities laws, but also antitrust laws or labor laws, that there can be incidental effects on speech that can be upheld under lesser scrutiny, under essentially not strict scrutiny. And what the Supreme Court was talking about in 44 Liquormart was concededly a direct regulation on speech. In that case, rather than exercise the state's police power to prohibit sales of alcohol or limit that conduct, the state of Rhode Island's simply said, well, you can't speak the prices. And what the Supreme Court said was, just because you could prohibit conduct doesn't mean you can indirectly get at the conduct through prohibiting speech. And in fact, speech has a higher importance under the Constitution. And so that's not valid. And I think, you know, what this court was saying in Wall Street Publishing was really the other side of the line, which is that there can be economic regulation that does have some incidental effect on speech. And I certainly think that that's where we fall in this case.
Why isn't your position, I didn't see this, I mean, you argued ripeness, but why aren't you saying, or are you saying also, that this is a facial attack on 13F, and therefore, if it's capable of any lawful application, the attack fails?
Well, you know, the petitioners have framed their challenge as an as-applied challenge, and I think...
But as applied to what? No submission. Well, no specific submission.
Right, and thus our ripeness argument. You know, I think with respect to the takings claim, there's some validity to the idea that this is an as-applied challenge because not every institutional investment manager is similarly situated. They don't all maintain the confidentiality of all of their holdings at all times, nor do we think full value really does, but that's sort of a separate point. With respect to the First Amendment challenge...
Let me stay with the takings for just a second. Until, without any factual development, how do we know there's any value to be taken?
Well, I mean, we agree, Your Honor. We think that's why we think this isn't ripe. We think that without going through the confidential treatment process, we don't even know if there's going to be any public dissemination here. I mean, Full Value has argued that all of their holdings are essentially trade secrets, which would mean, by the legal definition of a trade secret, they're in the process of acquisition or disposition. That is potentially subject to confidential treatment. So you're right, Your Honor.
Or as long as it remains in that status, I should say?
Right. As long as it's part
of an ongoing acquisition program.
As long as it's proven, you know, to the degree required by the rule. That's correct. I mean, the rule says confidential treatment is provided to securities which are part of an ongoing program of acquisition or disposition.
All right.
How
long has this strategy, how long has this dispute been going on? The Full Value doesn't submit, and you've been arguing about this.
4 years.
And before that, what happened?
The statute is only triggered once you meet the $100 million threshold, and so before that, they first met that threshold in March of 2006.
Okay. What was your response to Judge Ginsburg on the First Amendment and ripeness?
Well, I think there's sort of two points to be made there. We haven't made a technical ripeness claim on the First Amendment because it is a broad First Amendment challenge, and agencies usually don't address broad facial-type challenges in the first instance. That complicated a ripeness argument here. That being said, what Full Value has argued as is their First Amendment concern is the dissemination of their trade secrets, what they are worried about, other people copycatting their investment strategies. And that concern does not exist if confidential treatment is granted. And so I think the harm they allege would certainly be solved by a confidential treatment process. And there is at least one Eighth Circuit case that says that disclosure just to the government is not a compelled speech problem. If you're not publicly disseminating a message, you're not implicating First Amendment concerns.
Just so I understand, I think what you're saying is that the SEC defines what is the trade secret somewhat more narrowly than Full Value does. That is to say, you think it's only when they're in the process of acquisition that it can be a trade secret. And they seem to be saying something different, which is that the value that's being taken is the knowledge of what they've chosen, what's revealed in that disclosure. Is that correct?
Yeah, we do disagree. I mean, we think they are overstating what can legally be considered a trade secret. And if you look to the restatement definition of a trade secret, it talks about things that derive a competitive advantage from secrecy. First of all, not all of their holdings are always secret, given their business model by which they engage in proxy contests or shareholder proposals, holdings necessarily become public at some point. But beyond that, the competitive advantage that they've alleged here is an increase, or I guess by secrecy, the price of the stock stays down and they're able to more cheaply acquire their holdings. That's only an issue when they're in a program of acquisition or disposition. And that's the reason through the legislative history they've set up this confidential treatment process, and it's certainly something the commission has talked about.
Well, your understanding is that their whole case on the First Amendment rests on the idea that mere disclosure to the government is a violation of the First Amendment. I mean, it's different from all these other cases we're talking about where there was some other infringement different and larger than that. It seems to me their argument sounds like if we have to give you something that we hold dear, that's a violation of our speech, even though we don't know whether it's going to be disseminated.
Well, I think that is their assertion for why they don't have to go through the confidential treatment process, which is somewhat, I mean, I think they
that's,
do
that's
make...
That's the facial challenge, as you understand it?
Well, I think we might be using facial in two different ways. I mean, I think that is certainly the reason they think they don't have to play ball for the confidential treatment process. It's not the entirety of their First Amendment argument, because they would argue public dissemination is also a compelled speech problem. When I'm talking about as a
but your response, no, I want to make sure I'm understanding how you all are trying to join this issue. You said it in passing, the Eighth Circuit, that the mere disclosure to the government is not dissemination in your view.
That's correct. And that's why confidential treatment would address the First Amendment argument as well.
As I understand it, you're saying the issue cannot be joined. It's just not here, is what I'm hearing you say. Because merely requiring someone within, unless their first point is wrong, that there is simply no a legitimate government basis for any regulation here, unless their first point is correct. But assuming that you're past that, then all they're saying, the only thing they're arguing is if we have to give the government anything, that's a First Amendment violation. Forget whether it can later be disseminated. I understand that's a fight that could come later.
That's right. I think we haven't made the broad ripeness argument you're making with respect to the First Amendment, but I do think that for the very same reasons the commission was right in denying an exemption on this basis. Remember, we're here on the commission's interpretation that a 13F2 exemption is not appropriate when the concerns raised could be dealt with through the more limited process Congress set up of confidential treatment.
Right.
We think because it's not a First Amendment problem to give it just to the government, this does fall within that category and
argument.
Therefore an exemption.
There is no First Amendment issue to simply give the requested information to the government.
That's correct.
Okay.
I see that my time has run out. If the court has no further questions.
Thank you, Ms. Hurd. Ms. Hirsch, we'll give you 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We are correct here. Your position is that we don't need no stinking exemption.
I'm sorry?
Right. We don't need no stinking exemption, all right? That's your position. We don't have to give it. We don't have to give it to the government to ask.
We requested the exemption under 13F2, which they denied, and they gave us, they performed no analysis of why we should or shouldn't get the 13F2.
But did you request it with regard to a list of holdings?
Yes, we said we shouldn't have to turn over anything under 13F2.
I mean a specific, well, okay, so you, yeah, okay.
No. Okay. Well, 13F2
well,
is a broad exemption.
You're not getting why we're laughing, then we got a real problem.
No, but 13F2 is a broad exemption that was designed to exempt an entire class of persons. That's why it was. That's why Congress put it there. And the SEC just said, we're not even going to analyze it. We're not even going to look at it. You have to go apply for confidential treatment. And we said, well, then why is that there? We're an activist manager. Everything we do involves turning over our confidential information. We're not like an S&P 500 index fund.
So, you want to come in within the provision that says the commission by order may exempt any institutional investment manager.
Yes. Yes, that's what we requested. And with regard to Judge Edwards' earlier point about Wall Street Publishing, this I forgot to mention, it's in our brief, that Judge Lamberth of this court refused to file Wall Street Publishing because its continuing validity, quote, is at best questionable in light of the Supreme Court's most recent commercial speech cases, close quote.
Has he been confirmed for the Court of Appeals?
No.
Oh, all right. I thought I missed something. I'm not always around now.
And the district court judge in Toucher also disagreed.
That's the law of the circuit. The best that Judge Lamberth could do is say it looks like it's questioned. That's not the law of the circuit.
But assuming
respectfully.
That, respectfully, if that's the law of the circuit, even under Wall Street Publishing, we win. And the reason I say that is Wall Street Publishing, the government still, under the lowered standard in Wall Street Publishing, has to have a substantial interest. The law has to serve a substantial interest and has to advance that purpose. There's no purpose to this statute. The Inspector General as much concluded that when they said the SEC doesn't even look at that. The best evidence the SEC can muster as to what they've used this information for.
I understand your argument. That's the heart of your argument. The statute's nonsense. It serves no purpose. And so we don't have to do anything under this statute. And then your second argument is best. I'm saying this so I make sure I understand. Your second argument is that we have a First Amendment right that we can assert convincingly to prevent the government from requiring us to give them information. Forget the ultimate dissemination. Not to disseminate it, but just to give it to them.
Compelling us to speak, it necessary under Riley, I would request that the court focus on Riley because Riley says compelled speech is no different than restrained speech. And there is no difference between us being restrained from publishing a newsletter that contained the same information, the list of our holdings, as the government forcing us to publish the newsletter. Whether the government forces us to publish a newsletter, the 13F holdings, or restrains us from publishing that newsletter, it's the same constitutional violation.
I'm talking about merely submitting something to the government for its determination as to whether or not anything more should be done. I'm not finding cases.
I agree with you.
I'm not finding any cases, and I don't see Riley supporting that proposition.
Your Honor, I would agree with you. Just the mere act of submitting something to the government is not a First Amendment violation.
Right.
What makes it a First Amendment violation in this case is that what we're being forced to submit is protected speech. It's our securities holdings. It's our investment opinions. Lowe and CTS say investment opinions are fully protected speech.
You would be, so it's parallel, sort of the obverse of being required to submit to the government before you could publish.
I'm sorry?
You're saying it's analogous to or equivalent to being required to submit to the government something before you can publish it.
That's
something
right.
You
it's
want to publish.
It's a prior restraint.
So
this is a prior restraint case now?
No, it's a prior compulsion case.
Riley says there's really no difference.
All right, so when the CIA requires a former agent to submit a manuscript before it can be published because it might disclose things of national security interest. That is an instance of a presumably an exception to the rule against requiring permission.
I'm not an expert on that area of law.
Okay, but you can imagine that. So now you want an exception to compel, or you want to say that you can't be compelled, you can't be required to submit before compelled speech.
Just as
you can't be required to submit before free speech.
Yes, the act of requiring us to submit this information is compelled speech. It's forcing us.
Unless, again, the agency has some, like the CIA, has some compelling rationale.
Right, and in this case, there is no compelling rationale. There's not even a substantial interest. There's just absolutely no purpose to this.
That hinges on your argument that they're not doing anything useful as far as you can see.
But that can't be the dispositive, because
it
may be that.
That's what he started with. That was his opening.
I understand that, but the value of the value and the purpose of the disclosure requirement in the statute may not depend upon the SEC's doing anything with the information. It may depend upon the public having access to the information.
That's right.
That's what you object to, but the question is whether that's justified, not whether the SEC looks at it.
I think, yes, I'm agreeing with you that the court must analyze whether that the public having access to this information is any kind of substantial interest.
Right. And the SEC's failure to look at it first is irrelevant to that.
Yes. Well, what I'm doing is I'm eliminating any argument by the SEC that it serves some kind of regulatory purpose, that the SEC, they suggested in their order that it serves enforcement purposes. That's what they said in their order. And basically, the Inspector General said, no, you don't use it for anything. You don't even look at it. So, yes, I agree with the court. The analysis is whether the public having this information rises to the level of a substantial interest under Wall Street Publishing. Mm-hmm. And under, if you agree with us that Wall Street Publishing has been overruled, then under Lowe and CTS, they would have to show a compelling interest. And it's the government's burden to make this showing. It's not our burden.
Let me make sure I'm understanding your answers to Judge Ginsburg. Your submitting this information to the government in no way affects what you can otherwise do with your life and business, right?
It harms
us. There's no censorship. There's no requirement that you submit and then wait for the government to approve how you operate. It's not like a prior restraint in the sense that you can't publish this book or article until we look at it. That's not at all equatable.
I agree with that. Okay. It's not equatable.
That's where you seem to be going, and that is not this case. There's no prior restraint here.
No. What I was trying to illustrate is what is said in Riley, that there is no difference between restrained speech and compelled speech. Okay. The fact that speech is compelled doesn't make it any less protected.
Right. The other side of that is that this is not compelled speech. Documents, and then the question as to whether we're going to make you disseminate it is a question to be determined. Merely turning it over to us is nothing more than turning it over to us, because you can seek an exemption.
We sought an exemption.
I understand under the broad category. I understand that. Okay.
Right.
I just want to make sure I understood.
Thank you, Mr. Hirsch. Ms. Hardin, thank you, too. The case is submitted.